You haven't seen anything yet. Donald Trump marking his first 100 days in office with a rally in Michigan, where he told enthusiastic supporters, "We've just gotten started." Of course, not everyone's a fan. UK magazine The Economist putting a battered American bald eagle on its cover with the caption, "Only 1,361 days to go." But what if it's too late to reverse 100 days of rule by executive order? What if the president's already eroded for good the power of the legislative and judicial branches of government in the U.S.? Among the daily test of boundaries, last week's arrest by federal agents of a judge in Milwaukee for refusing to let her courtroom become the scene of an arrest for a man wanted for deportation. That's on top of a long list of punitive actions against all those who, in the words of the White House, quote, "don't love America." The U.S. in uncharted territory at home and abroad. There are consequences when the world's most powerful nation turns on Ukraine, abandons the fight against global warming, and arbitrarily imposes tariffs on the allies. So could enough Americans stay silent while a 249-year-old republic veers away from democracy? It all begins with the next 100 days. Today in the France 24 debate, we're wondering if it's only the beginning. With us, Lee Hockstetter, European affairs columnist at The Washington Post. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Madeline Schwartz is editor-in-chief of The Dial, also professor of journalism at the French Political Science Institute, Sciences Po. Good to see you.
Nice to see you.
Pierre Gervais, professor of American civilization at the University of Sorbonne Nouvelle. You know a lot about tariffs in the 18th century.
Yes. Less in the 21st century.
That's your specialty. Thanks for being with us. If you're on the go, by the way, you can listen to the show. That's right. Listen to the debate wherever podcasts are streamed. In France, we call them decrees. Donald Trump signing many more executive orders than any of his past century's predecessors in his first 100 days. On this chart, you just see the most recent ones. He signed more, in fact, than Franklin Roosevelt did during times of war. Rule by decree? Well, James Vezina has that story.
It's a fundamental principle of U.S. governance. The checks and balances structure is designed to prevent any one person from wielding too much power. But in the first 100 days of his second term as president, Donald Trump has largely succeeded in outplaying this system. He got into action on his very first day, signing, as he'd promised throughout his campaign, a large number of executive orders. These written directives instruct government to take specific actions, and in 100 days he signed well over 100 orders. Among his first was the blanket pardoning of 1,500 insurrectionists convicted for the attack on the Capitol. Some of his orders have been taken to the Supreme Court.
Birthright citizenship is about slavery.
Such as his directive to end birthright citizenship, which is the part of the Constitution that declares anybody born on U.S. soil to be a citizen. Trump is seeking to ban automatic citizenship for children whose parents are in the country illegally, but his order was blocked by federal district courts in three states. And Trump has ignored certain rulings, including one from the country's highest court that ordered the government to help Kilmer Abrego-Garcia return to the United States after he was erroneously expelled and sent to his home country of El Salvador. Another decision by a federal court forbid his administration from banning the Associated Press news agency from the White House, but the president has yet to act on this too. Donald Trump and congressional Republicans have also threatened to impeach judges going against his agenda, such as James Boasberg, who Trump labelled a radical left lunatic, after the judge ordered a temporary halt to the deportation of alleged Venezuelan gang members.
Judge.
Meanwhile, two judges have been arrested by federal authorities, accused of interfering with the administration's immigration agenda. And several investigations into Trump, started during the previous administration, have been halted. Career Justice Department lawyers have been fired without explanation. Dozens are fighting their dismissals, some of whom had worked on investigations into the attack on the Capitol. But he hasn't just gone after civil servants. Private law firms are also in his sights, with Trump's executive orders placing restrictions on four major law firms that have represented clients who've challenged his policies in court or represented people who've previously investigated him. Some companies have stepped into line by agreeing to provide hundreds of millions of dollars worth of free legal services to initiatives that Trump supports, this to avoid sanctions. The American Bar Association, which the White House labeled a, quote, snooty organization, said that the Trump administration is attempting to tip the scales of justice.
Well, let's start with the latest as reported on the front page of this Wednesday's Washington Post. Postal workers roped into helping the Trump administration's efforts to deport undocumented foreign nationals. Lee Hockstetter, how's American democracy doing?
That's of a piece of this broader strategy to expand presidential powers way beyond what anybody imagined. There are no guardrails. Much of what we expect to be norms in the United States are not codified. They're not written into law. They're not part of the Constitution. They're often determined by tradition, and that's what Trump has launched an assault on. That's what he's destroying principally. And we could talk about, you know, many different realms of this. I think that his attack on universities, science, research, these are the sort of things that are going to have very, very long-lasting consequences. I'll be happy to come back to that.
And more so than in this particular case, the sort of the manhunt for all those who are in the U.S. illegally.
You know, the deportation numbers really aren't that extraordinary. They may get that way over time. I don't think we've seen the worst of it. I think when you're talking about cutting off basic research, basic science, the things that have made American universities preeminent and dominant in the world, it's been federal funding, by and large. The National Institutes of Health, the National Science Foundation. We talk about Harvard, for example, $2 billion in cuts that Harvard is facing. A great part of that goes to five hospitals in the Boston area that are affiliated with Harvard University and that do basic research on public health, on diseases that affect ordinary people in their ordinary lives. And those research projects are grinding to a halt. Researchers are being laid off. And those are the kinds of things that will be very, very long-lasting. You can't just stop a research project, lay off hundreds of people, and that it's doing very, very important work on cancer research, on immune diseases, on Alzheimer's, on a whole host of diseases that we all know about, and interrupt that kind of research and expect it to sort of just snap back if a court rules in your favor after lots of appeals a year from now. That will have very long-lasting repercussions.
All right. And it's certainly something that our correspondent in Los Angeles has been looking at. Wassim Cornet, who went to the campus of the University of California at Los Angeles to hear how people feel about these threats that have been put in place by the government against for taking away their federal funding.
At UCLA, one of America's top public research universities, the stakes are high. Many scientists and researchers here say they're being deliberately targeted, not just with budget cuts, but because of some of the issues they're working on, like climate change, which clash directly with the Trump administration's agenda.
We began this study in the summer of 2024, and we're full steam ahead in February and received out of the blue without warning a letter saying that the project needed to cease immediately. The title of the project had the word equity in it. I'm guessing perhaps that it was that word that triggered the request to stop the project. I don't know it for sure.
So there is absolutely a climate of both fear and of incredible uncertainty about what the next 6 months, year, 3 years are going to hold for higher education.
It is concerning. It is a little gloomy. It doesn't paint in like the greatest hope, especially now that the competition is getting more fierce internationally. Having these impacts affect not only the first 4 years, but possibly much more, it puts us in a precarious situation.
A proposed cap on indirect funding could cost UCLA nearly $200 million, a blow that many fear could cripple public funding. The threat of cuts is also affecting campuses all across the country, leading this week's edition of Nature magazine to ask this daunting question: will U.S. science survive Trump 2.0?
Pierre Gervais, there was the University of Marseille X here in France that put out a call to researchers who wanted to come, and they were flooded with candidacies.
Yeah, there is a problem there because the French system is not in any state to receive large numbers of American researchers with the proper amount of either money or research facilities. So that will limit severely the possibility for Americans to come here. I'm more worried about their political future, frankly. I mean, I think this entire defunding is actually an effort to put universities under political control, control their speech, control their management of possible oppositions within them. I think the real goal of all this is not necessarily to stop science, though it may be transferred for corrupt reasons to private institutions such as Elon Musk and other people. But besides this possible corrupt goal, there is a goal of political control. And the fact of closing down debate and closing down in the universities, closing off the people who could debate, is very much a sign of shift towards authoritarianism. We saw that in Orban Hungary, for instance.
Madeline Schwartz?
I agree. And I think that one of these, well beyond the universities, there's a huge risk, and in fact, not even a risk, it's already happening, of a chilling of freedom of speech and of people even wanting to talk about what is happening. I was actually surprised watching the report of your colleague that he was able to get three people with their faces on the record to talk about what is happening, when I see and read so many pieces today about this very subject where people do not want to be talking for fear of reprisal, for fear of being attacked. And that is not the sign of a healthy, functioning democracy.
So what are the options? The options are what? You either go abroad, but as you said, Pierre Gervais said that you have to find the money to do so. You grin and bear it and hope that the midterms come around soon enough, or what?
That's the question that everyone is asking, and I'm not sure that I have necessarily the greatest answer. As you can see, I'm just struggling to find it myself. But one thing that has been surprising to me is how little pushback there has been from some of these institutions that have, in many cases, very large endowments, that have the resources to fight back in all sorts of ways. Harvard is a rare exception to that, as it has pushed back against many of Trump's demands, while at the same time acceding to others. So one cannot imagine anything will change without more pushback than there has been up until now.
Lee Hockstetter?
You know, the other danger is that there are options. These researchers, these world-class scientists may not be able to come to France, but they can sure go to China. In China, the research funding remains available. The National Institutes of Health is by far the world's biggest scientific grant-giving organization, $33 billion in 2022. There's no private money that can replace that in the United States. But the Chinese government, there's an option. And China, of course, will be very interested in attracting some of these researchers who may be already in the United States or may have been thinking about where to go next from whatever country they're in now. And China is going to be a very attractive option. Donald Trump, you could say, is the best president that China has ever had in many dimensions, including this issue that we're talking about, science and research.
And at what point do business leaders who helped him get elected push back and say no?
That's a great question. I think we all noticed a week or two ago when Republican Senator from Alaska, Lisa Murkowski, said, we're all afraid. Now, this is a senator from Trump's own party, credible source. Everybody's afraid because Trump has made retribution a central part of his modus operandi. And if corporate leaders push back, well, they know there can be consequences. And universities also. Everybody is afraid to push back because Trump is very surgical in striking back to anyone who might challenge him.
All right. We were talking at the outset about this push weed out illegal migrants. If you look at opinion polls on both sides of the Atlantic, that's popular. People don't want an influx of uncontrolled migrants, according to all opinion polls. However, there are fears that it's going even further. The American Civil Liberties Union advocacy group stating, for instance, that there's growing concern that President Donald Trump might invoke the Insurrection Act. It's a law from 1798 to bring National Guard troops under federal control and deploy them within the United States. Now, they haven't done it, Pierre Gervais.
No, it's actually, again, you have to frame it within a prospect in which Donald Trump is not interested in submitting to business leaders. He has his plan. It's such as it is, and it's an authoritarian plan, and he will use any means necessary to do that. One of the mistakes, I think, of the people who are still in the business community supporting the Republican Party in the hopes that Trump will somehow become reasonable, that's something we saw in Germany as well in 33, 34, Trump will not become reasonable. Trump will actually accelerate his attempt to seize complete total power. It may not be done that way, but if every single center of opposition, lawyers, universities, and also people demonstrating in the streets eventually are shut off and cannot demonstrate, if, for instance, next fall elections are not free, then that's the end of it.
You're comparing to 1933 Germany when Hitler came to power?
Well, yeah, it's a milder version, like a postmodern version, I would say. But in the principle of it, you are having a person who wants to be all-powerful. You are having a party who is afraid of providing any kind of reining in on that ambition. And you are having the tools to turn the United States into something very nasty. The tools are there. The law is extremely ambiguous on a number of points, and you can actually end up with something extremely violent. Yes.
But there are safeguards in the United States still. Now, for instance, there was shock last month when what appeared to look like hooded gunmen, something you would have seen normally in places like Russia, arrested a 30-year-old Turkish graduate student in the suburbs of Boston. Passersby even spoke up. Before those people identified themselves as immigration police. This Wednesday, though, a judge in Vermont ordering the release of a Palestinian man who led protests against the war in Gaza, a student at Columbia University. He was arrested by immigration officials earlier this month during an interview about finalizing his U.S. citizenship. Mohsen Madawi's message for Trump was, "I'm not afraid." So, Madeline Schwartz, you see, the United States has a democracy. The federal judge in Vermont says, no, let him out of jail.
I saw this news about Madawi right before I came on, and, you know, that is very big news, but we can't lose sight of the fact that there are still a number of students in detention, including Rumeza Öztürk, the student who's from Tufts, who was arrested by hooded agents, masked agents, a few weeks ago. Many of these students are not held in Vermont. They're held in Louisiana, a state which has a number of immigration detention centers, a state where judges are very hostile to migration, and where the ultimate decision might be very different from the one we just saw today in Vermont.
Now, the U.S. Secretary of State stating in the last hour, Lee Hockstetter, that the U.S. is searching for more countries to take in migrants from the U.S. after El Salvador. Of course, Italy's trying the same thing with Albania. We can perhaps show images from 2023 when you had the President of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, in the company of the Italian Prime Minister and the then Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte, traveling to Tunisia for years they've been paying the Turkey and been offering deals to Libya to keep migrants away. So has Europe been doing the same thing as the United States, only not so brashly when it comes to foreign?
Well, you know, the Turkey deal that you just referenced, that was actually quite effective. Turkey was paid quite a bit of money by the European Union, and those numbers of migrants, I think mostly from Syria, they stopped very quickly. Those numbers went down by 90% plus right away because the Turks were effective in stopping them. And, you know, that is a model that would have a lot of political support and that you could see Trump trying to replicate. Obviously, you know, money is no problem for the United States. He's willing to keep deficit spending. And so payments, as Trump is doing with El Salvador, to house those immigrants, those could be effective.
And those could be effective. So, again, what's the difference then between Europe and the United States?
Well, I think Trump has demonstrated a level of cruelty and even taken pride in that cruelty in a way that almost no European leader, even Viktor Orban, would dare or has imagined to try.
How do you explain that cruelty? As you put it.
Well, I guess you'd have to get Donald Trump on the couch. But what we've seen is that no matter what he does, no matter what depths of cruelty he descends to, he has a base of support, something around 40%, who, as he said, wouldn't desert him even if he shot somebody in the middle of Fifth Avenue. Probably the truest words that Donald Trump ever uttered. They don't abandon him. It doesn't matter how bad what he does is. For example, the splitting up families, taking children away from their parents in his first administration. There wasn't any particular loss of support. He backpedaled, but there was no loss of that base hardcore of support that he enjoys of 40% or so.
All right. Lee Hockstetter framing it as cruelty. But Madeline Schwartz, what it is, though, is tapping into an anger. What's that anger all about?
Well, I go back to what Lee said about this question of effectiveness and, you know, what... Effective for what? One real difference between what Trump has been doing and what European leaders have done it with regard to that Turkey deal is that what Trump calls suspected gang members aren't just sent back to the countries that they have been that they came from, but they have been sent into horrible, horrible prisons from which there is essentially no
instead
escape.
Of Venezuela, El Salvador.
In El Salvador, I at the Dial, the magazine I edit, we've published a fair bit of reporting from El Salvador and. About these prison systems, and the conditions are absolutely terrible. And there's a very big difference between sending someone back and incarcerating them. I find that in some ways, listening to this conversation, I am being forced into the uncomfortable position of being a little bit of an optimist, which is to say, yes, Trump has a base that has been very, very happy. All the poll numbers have shown that. But actually, when one looks at the American people more broadly, they're not very happy. And in fact, Trump's support has been going down steadily over the course of these first 100 days. And that, to me, is somewhat significant. The question is, you know, what alternative is out there? What is being presented that's not Trump? And that's something that I think a lot of people need to be thinking about very hard and very quickly.
Pierre Gervais, what's the view here, then, in terms of when you see this? Because... Is it the end of democracy in America the way it's been since the Constitution was ratified there in 1789?
I would say it's a distinct possibility. We have to get back to that anger issue. Basically, you have a basis of 30% people who buy into a program, which is essentially a program not so much of them getting so much out of what Trump is doing, because they're not, but them getting status and satisfaction out of crushing other people, because that's what it's really about. And that basis will stay because the program of crushing other people is very attractive. I mean, if you look at the southern states before the end of slavery, there was a sizable number of small farmers who didn't have slaves and were not taking advantage of slavery. Actually, they were rather marginalized by the power of big planters, but they were still backing slavery because they were all those slaves they could crush. So there is that. There is the attraction. The attraction is reinforced by the anger over the evolution of the past 10 years or so. The inflation has been very high in housing, in education, in healthcare, and a large part of the American population had no access anymore to these services, or less and less. And they're furious about that because they have lost a considerable amount of access to wealth and simply necessities. And the third thing is, to answer your first question about the difference, this is all about due process. I mean, we in Europe managed to leave the fact that these people are out of our borders, so we don't have to deal with them through the process, due process. If they get into our borders, however, even Meloni was forced to give them some amount of due process, because that's what democracies do. So the Europe is actually aiming as much as possible at keeping people out, because that way they are not stuck. Now, the difference with Trump is that even though they're inside, they still don't have due process. And more worryingly, even American citizens eventually will have no due process. Three very young American citizens were deported last week. They were deported because their mother didn't want to leave them behind. But it is a precedent of American citizens having been deported in a black hole. And I think Timothy Snyder actually pointed out it's one of the basic tools of dictatorship. You just disappear. And that's something which can maybe one day happen to opponents, American citizens Trump is unhappy about. We don't know. I'm not saying it's a certainty, but it's certainly a possibility at this point.
All right, let's try to build on Madeline's newfound optimism here. Lee Hockstetter, we're talking about this due process issue here. There's going to be midterms, but before that, the executive orders, that's easy, a stroke of a pen. Judicial time is longer. It's a bit more complicated. But it finally works. There's pushback in the last hour. There's been more rulings, this one about Guantanamo, while we were speaking. So at the end of the day, the system will catch up with Donald Trump. And lawmakers, like you were referencing that Republican senator from Alaska, they will push back at some point. So at the end of the day, can you put it all back in a box?
I wouldn't be quite that optimistic, but to follow on the theme of optimism, if we're asking the question about the durability of this extreme expansion of executive power, this overreach, well, it is, as we've said, by executive order. Executive orders can be overturned at the stroke of a pen. We're all sort of dazzled by all these executive orders, but at the same time, if you look at his actual legislative record, he's completely uninterested in pushing bills through Congress. He's passed exactly 5 bills in 100 days. That's nothing. And some of those were routine. So, you know, what's done by executive order can be undone by executive order. And in the event that there's a Democratic victory in the House, which is extremely likely in 2026 elections, and then a turnover in the White House 4 years from now, which is possible, we could be looking at a mood in the country in which legislators want to codify guardrails so that no future president could go this far again.
Well, we did that. There was in the United States the War Powers Act because it was never war declared for the Vietnam War. So that reined in the executive's branch's power. You're saying that we're going to see the legislative branch of government perhaps strengthen as a result of this?
Well, here's an example. Trump has deported these hundreds of immigrants to the huge mega prison in El Salvador using the Alien Enemies Act, 200-year-old or more law that was really intended for and written by Congress back then in the 18th century for time of war. And Trump has sort of said, well, we're under invasion by these immigrants. Well, this is preposterous, of course.
He's declared 8 of those national emergencies that he makes akin to a time of war.
Right, a time of war. Well, Congress could certainly legislate specifically to define what is actually a time of war. That's one example of how Congress could step in and place guardrails to avoid a repetition of this.
And the question now is whether you've convinced Pierre Gervais.
My worry is that there won't be any elections next fall in any significant way.
No elections?
I mean, yeah, there will be formally elections, but somehow Democrats won't be able to vote. I mean, that's my worry. This is a party which is actually actively, as we speak, organizing to eventually rig the election this fall. I mean, they're trying to undermine the possibility of voting in places where Democrats vote, Cook County or places like that. They're trying to cut...
But how much voter suppression has there been? This is an issue.
There's been a huge amount of voter suppression already. So you have states where the congressional delegation is way off compared to the split between Democrats and Republicans. You take Ohio, it's ridiculous. You take North Carolina, it's ridiculous. You have about 2/3 of the delegation Republican, whereas it's half and half in the popular vote. You push that a little bit further, and then you don't have to lose elections ever again. And that's what people like, you know, Viktor Orban have been doing, not mentioning Putin with more brutality. And the only thing which should intervene in this case are the courts. But again, the courts don't have an army. So if the elections were lost, I don't see what they can do.
Madeline Schwartz?
Well, I think there are really two things to keep in mind here. The first is that part of the reason that Trump is able to have, so much of a hold, I think, on a large part of the American population is because he is going after things that are actually pretty unpopular. And in a time when many people are very unsatisfied, have very low trust in the government, and do not feel, as Professor Gervais just said, that they are getting the kinds of services that they want, that their tax money is going to good use. So, if one wants to think about, America after Trump, the United States after Trump, you really have to ask, what are the other answers to these questions? One thing that Trump is very good at is putting, the Democrats, civil society on the defensive. But how can they think about providing new answers to these issues that so concern voters? I think that's a really important piece of the puzzle to keep in mind going forward.
Go ahead.
Oh, the second thing I'll say is, there are many examples that we can compare the United States to, some more terrifying than others. But one example that's worth keeping in mind is Poland, where until recently there was a far-right government that went after the judiciary, that did sweeping overhauls of Polish society, went after independent media, and actually they were elected out of office, in large part because they were so unpopular, in particular with some anti-abortion laws that led to women dying, that the Polish people came out. I mean, one can look at footages of protests that are incredible, millions of people in the street fighting against some of these policies. And in the end, that directly translated into a democratic election in which this party was out of power. What will happen in Poland in the future? Who knows? But I think that's a really good example for Americans to be looking at right now.
But you were earlier worrying aloud about the fact that there is not very much pushback in the United States. What if most Americans don't actually care about these issues of due process?
I think that there's a lot that Americans do care about, and due process can be seen in all sorts of ways. Issues of families being separated at the border, that is something that Americans do care about and do follow. The sense that that Trump is putting together a chaotic environment in which people can't, make decisions on a day-to-day basis, that is something that is already showing up in polling across the United States and that people care about very deeply.
Lee Hockstetter?
I think the state capture example from Poland is really an apt example, and the pushback that you saw in the Law and Justice Party being defeated after this overreach and state capture. In the United States, there may be reason to hope in terms of what the courts could do and in terms of what the polls are showing. Trump's never been a very popular president, neither in his first term nor in his second. He was rarely above 50%, and now he's closer to 40%. But where Americans in polls really... what they really don't like is the idea that courts, judges, rulings will be ignored or scoffed at, which is exactly what Trump has sort of toyed with. That polls extremely poorly. And so that's the kind of overreach, ignoring court rulings, even a Supreme Court ruling, that could contribute to an electoral pushback that might be a wave.
But Lee, there's been this arrest of this judge in Milwaukee, and there were a few protests, but... in France, you'd have millions in the streets, right?
She's a state judge, and that was an unthinkable thing until it happened. The federal judiciary is sort of another thing, and under the wing of John Roberts. John Roberts has no army, but...
this is the Chief Justice of the
Chief Justice of the United States. He has no army. However, he certainly has a bully pulpit, as Theodore Roosevelt called it. People listen when the Chief Justice of the United States speaks, and even Trump listened. Remember when... Roberts warned him against attacking a federal judge and threatening impeachment. Trump said, oh, but he didn't mention me, although he was clearly talking about Trump. There are these kind of moral systemic norms that could catch up to Trump.
I think the one elephant in the room we should talk about is the ability of the opposition to actually organize. And that's, I don't know enough about Poland to know who was actually organizing those demonstrations. But a key element in the opposition, I think you're right to have some kind of hope there, a key element to the opposition, of a massive opposition to Trump, is the development of networks and media, social media platforms, and eventually parties able to organize those demonstrations. One of the problems we have now is the deconstruction of the Democratic Party as an opposition party due to its capture, I think, by people who are way too tolerant of what is going on at this point. That's my position, at least. And I think what we really need, but urgently, before next elections, is an organized opposition where people will actually, you know, meet and do things. And that's something which is missing at this point. That's what you were mentioning. I think you're right. I mean, that's what's so worrying. I mean, of course, if the mass of the population goes into the street, there is hope that it will end up well. There is also a possibility it won't. There are places where it didn't end well. I'm thinking of Iran, for instance. But you know, I mean, yeah, we need that organized opposition.
The Democratic Party, which has always coalesced around one leader, just like the Republican Party, has gone from the party of states' rights to the party of Donald Trump. Lee Hockstetter, if you look at the Republican Party today, there's this coalition around Trump, right? There's the circle of protectionists, those who were at the rally in Michigan on Tuesday night and who approve of tariffs. You have the Wall Street types, including those tech bros, as we call them, from Silicon Valley. And then there are those who have a more ideological far-right agenda. This coalition can fall apart, too.
The problem with the United States in this context that we're talking about is that it's not a parliamentary system. In other words, there's no appointed formal leader of the opposition. Nobody knows who the leader of the Democratic Party is, and nobody really will know until their primaries in 2028 and a new presidential nominee is elected in the primaries in the states. Until then, it's sort of a free-for-all. There is no formal appointed leader of the opposition, and that's really costing the Democrats right now. There is no coalescing force, no coalescing personality in the Democratic Party.
I'm putting you on the spot here, Madeline. If there was one defining moment of these first 100 days, what would it be?
I keep thinking about the very first day when Donald Trump, you know, in the middle of his inauguration, was surrounded by people like Elon Musk and Zuckerberg and all sorts of and Jeff Bezos. And that has ultimately been who the presidency has benefited so far. And in some sense, that image may come back to haunt him if some of the large changes he has made really go forward.
So are you saying it's an oligarchy in Washington?
I will let my academic colleague here take that one.
It's a bit more complicated because people tend to think that Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos call the shots. I don't think they do, actually. They can push, they can pressure, but they are not the ones in charge. Trump is. And so it's not, I wouldn't call that an oligarchy. I would call that a dictatorship in the making.
Or a kleptocracy.
Yeah. Or a combination of the two, if we can compromise.
What's certain is that on this side of the Atlantic, there were two defining moments that came almost in succession. First, the vice president preferring to meet the leader of Germany's Nazi-rooted far right and not the sitting chancellor before a general election there. And then in February, telling the Munich Security Conference, the threat I worry the most about vis-a-vis Europe is not Russia, it's not China, it's any external actor. Rather, it's the threat from within. He blasted woke culture and immigration. Then came that meltdown of a sit-down at the White House.
You're gambling with the lives of millions of people. You're gambling with World War III.
Donald Trump stunning everybody in Europe, I guess, beginning with the Ukrainians. Pierre Gervais, nobody expected that.
Well, I did, actually. I mean, this is... Trump has been shored up by Russian money throughout the 2000s. His son actually declared that in so many words. He was paid by the Russians for years. He admires Putin and thinks he's a model politically. He went into power, decided to help and further Russian goals. So I knew before this happened that, yes, Zelensky was not going to get what he wanted out of Trump. Now, the thing is more unclear now, but less clear now, because there may be some kind of difference between Putin and Trump, but I wouldn't bet on it. even then. And if I was Europe, I would act fast because there is no guarantee that Trump will go on doing what the U.S. did traditionally.
So Trump was elected a first time. He walked away from the Paris Climate Accords. Then afterwards, it could all seem like a bad dream. The U.S. rejoined the Paris Accords. Of course, he left again on day one. When it comes to NATO, when it comes to what's going on in Ukraine, is something broken that can't be put back together again when it comes to the Atlantic Alliance?
Sometimes it's interesting to look at what has not happened. In these first 100 days, I think it's fair to say that Trump has not been confronted by any global major crisis. So he's been in a situation where he hasn't really, and the United States hasn't really needed friends in a crisis. And this comes to your question about Europe and about Ukraine and about Russia. If there's a crisis, if there's a transatlantic crisis, if there's a new terrorist attack in the United States, there will come a time, I think, when the United States will be in need of allies. Even the United States, which all of its power and all of its military might has had the need for allies in the past. And that could come back to haunt Trump, that he's alienated all of his allies, all the traditional allies that the United States has.
But how will those traditional allies react?
Yeah, I guess we'll see, because it would be a big ask at this point, wouldn't it, to think that they would rally to Trump's side or that they would send troops, as they have in recent wars over the last couple of decades, to fight alongside Americans. The Danes are one example. The Danes were the most faithful NATO allies that the United States had. Danish troops dying at very high numbers in proportion to their population in Afghanistan. And here you have it paid back by a threat to take over Greenland. I think Trump's going to have a hard time finding allies next time he needs them.
Madeline Schwartz, why is it unraveling?
I've been surprised from that respect in thinking about, you know, how the end of public diplomacy that we're seeing, but also how slowly some of the United States' allies were to react to so many of these changes. I was a journalist in Berlin during Trump's first term, and, you know, kept reading papers about how, the United States was turning away from Europe. And in that time, Europe did actually very little to prepare itself for what has now come to happen. And unfortunately, that has put it a bit on the back foot in thinking about how to maintain defense in a very uncertain time.
As an American in Paris now, no longer in Berlin, your thoughts on what it means at this point in time to be an American when you're here in Europe?
Well, I think it's a very interesting time, and there's certainly a lot that the United States can learn from France in thinking about doing its best to maintain a strong welfare state.
Pierre Gervais, of course, in the 249 years that the United States has existed here in France, we've had five republics, two monarchies, two Napoleonic dictatorships, Vichy France. So for us, having democracy being undermined, that's something that happens regularly. We had an attempted coup in 1961.
Well, yeah, the circumstances were a bit different. I would like both to reduce the idea that the United States is completely stable.
But we think democracy is forever.
They had a large civil war, if you remember, with a country, the Confederacy, which had slavery. So it was the American Republic went through stages like the rest of the universe. What happened was that they escaped so far what we knew from the 1890s to the 1930s, 40s, which was the rise of an extreme right authoritarian dictatorships reacting to the shift towards industrial capitalism. And yes, the United States didn't know that particular period of instability. It may come. That's all I have to say. I mean, it may be coming now as we speak, or they can escape it again. But this is something which has to be judged locally, so to speak. There is no, traditions are important, but at some point they break down. And we're very far. I'm giving you for an example the power of the purse. Everybody is talking about the power of the purse in Congress. Congress has the power of the purse. You look at the Constitution, it's not the power of the purse, it's the power to tax. There is nothing in the Constitution which says that Congress should decide how to spend. So you could change that. It's not impossible. Of course, if you give all the power to spend to the president, you're giving him all power over the country. So the rules can be changed significantly.
The rules
can flexible.
The rules can be changed. That's the word of warning we'll end on. So much more to talk about. Pierre Chauvet, I want to thank you. I want to thank Madeleine Schwartz, Lee Hochstetter.
Thank you
for being with us here in the France 24 debate.
Your stories inspire the future. Your daily lives create the news. Your cultures, struggles, and successes are at the heart of our programs. We tell the stories of those who made our planet and those who are building it. We tell the story of the world shaped by the lives of those who live there.
Liberté, égalité, actualité.
On April 25th, 2015, a devastating earthquake struck Nepal.
There were houses and hotels on the hilltop. They were all destroyed and buried in the landslide.
The consequences were catastrophic. Thousands of people died.
Every family lost at least one or two members, and some even five.
10 years later, seismologists, architects, and geologists battle daily to preserve and rebuild the country.
By 2050, our dream is to make the entire country earthquake resistant. By 2050, and it can be done.
Revisiting Nepal 10 years after the disaster on France 24.